Welcome to the Soccer Central Podcast.
Well, good Thursday there, football fans, and welcome to the Soccer Central Podcast. James Charmonnier, as always, alongside Sportsnet.ca's senior football writer, John Molinaro, on what's been a very busy week, maybe not quite as busy as you may have thought, with the transfer deadline being a bust, it's fair to say. I mean, there's lots of moves,
well,
right?
There was moves.
No major moves, though.
No, not certainly not amongst the top four.
I mean, if you're Hull, there's a hell of a lot of moves. I think seven guys came in in the window.
And Watford lost, his name escapes me.
Watford?
Yeah.
Agallo.
Yeah, who went to China. And Walter Mazzari wasn't too happy about that.
No. But apparently this whole China thing is going to slowly come to a grinding halt, given that the government have turned the four three, and the thoughts of Carlos Tevez, etc., coming for such big money has been a little bit unpalatable, apparently, to the Chinese authorities. But anyway, that's for a different show, okay, Jomo?
Yes,
today.
We'll probably talk about a show on that one day.
At some point, we will. Yeah. Maybe we'll fly over to China and do a show. I'm sure we'll get that budget approved. Later today, we'll talk to Julian de Guzman, who retired this past week from football, age 35. Julian, a long-time proud servant of our country, and a really fantastic career from France, Spain, Germany, Greece, obviously here in Toronto.
He was, I mean, during his time at Deportivo La Coruña, he was probably one of the best holding midfielders in La Liga. So for a Canadian, that's pretty
holding
amazing.
Holding midfielders. So when Mo Johnston brought him to TFC as an attacking midfielder.
That's another story
we'll get into with Julian.
Yeah,
we will. Let's start though today with some Premier League chat with Tom Williams from AFP. Tom, welcome back to the show.
Thanks for having me back.
Big news, I guess not big news per se. It's not unexpected, although there were rumours that he might be going somewhere this January. But Frank Lampard has announced his retirement from football. 21 years he played for West Ham, for Chelsea, a cup of tea, you could say, at Man City, New York City FC. But a great servant for those clubs and for his country as well. One of the great Premier League midfielders, I'd say. Where would you rate him in the realm of great Premier League midfielders, Tom?
I think you'd have to put him in the top two or three. The only guy who comes to mind who can really hold a torch to him is Steven Gerrard. And of course, famously, those two never managed to find a way of making their midfield partnership work for England. But certainly over the course of his career, Frank Lampard, I mean, he scored goals at a phenomenal rate for a central midfielder. And also, this is someone who wasn't a freak of nature. We're used to seeing wingers score lots of goals, but to see a guy playing in a pretty old-fashioned box-to-box role score as many goals as he did, as consistently as he did, over so many seasons, and so many key goals as well, and so many great goals. I mean, he was a real sort of comic hero footballer in a way. And I think the great thing about Lampard is that when he first emerged on the scene, when he came through at West Ham, there's a very famous YouTube clip that I'd advise anyone to look up if they haven't already seen it, which is Harry Redknapp, the former West Ham manager, appearing at some fans forum back in the mid to late 90s. And Frank Lampard, looking a lot more youthful then than he does now, was sitting alongside him. And there were fans in the room asking why Lampard was being played. There was this feeling that, you know, it was favouritism because of, you know, his father being Frank Lampard Sr. And Harry Redknapp, to his credit, said, look, this lad here is going to go to the very top. And he was very specific on that point. And here we are looking back, whatever, 20 years later, he's been proven completely right. I think the thing that really sets Lampard apart is his work rate. There's this semi-obsession in England about what we call natural footballers, and natural footballers tend to be people like Gerrard, like Wayne Rooney, players who play with a bit of swagger, who look like they were born with a ball at their feet. Lampard has never really been that sort of player. You know, everything that he achieved in the game, he owes to his own bloody single-mindedness and his enormous dedication, the hours and hours that he put in doing extra work on the training ground, and gave him this incredible career. So yeah, I mean, you know, as you say, it's been on the cards for a little while now. He's been winding his career down in the States. But yeah, a fantastic career. And I think even, you know, we get a bit obsessed talking about things in terms of the Premier League and framing them in that context. But if you talk about the vast sweep of English football history, you know, Lampard belongs with the great English midfielders. The only thing you can say against him is that he never did it for England, but he's far from alone in that case. So yeah, a really, really astounding career.
The thing that really astounds me about him, Tom, was, as you said, his sort of consistency, but also his professionalism. I can't remember him ever kind of being, you know, wrapped up in any tabloid kind of controversy or anything like that. He just seemed to be a pretty straightforward guy who got on with the business and didn't sort of really revel in the celebrity lifestyle or culture that so often surrounds football.
Yeah, that's true. You know, I can't think of any, you know, Lampard scandals, certainly not from the last sort of, you know, 10, 15 years of his career. I think he's, you know, I think he's always had a pretty settled head on his shoulders. I think he knew what he wanted to achieve in football very early on. And I think he knew what he would need to do in order for that to happen. And obviously, you know, his great stroke of luck, if you like, was the fact that he'd already arrived at Chelsea by the time Roman Abramovich swept in with his millions, followed by Jose Mourinho. But, you know, there were plenty of other Chelsea players who were already there when Mourinho came in. And it was only, you know, Lampard, Terry, who managed to become part of the furniture of that exceptional Chelsea team. And I think in a way, you know, there is something, there's a bit of the throwback about Lampard, this sort of clean living, clean cut, usually clean shaven guy, quite a conventional sort of footballer, really, a kind of all round midfielder, goal scoring midfielder. And, you know, I think someone who is held in high regard by people right across European and world football.
Yeah, great story with Frank Lampard. He once said that when Jose Mourinho arrived, one of the first things he told him was, listen, do what I say and I'll make you the best midfielder in the world. Mm. And maybe he didn't quite reach those heights, but not far off. He was very, very good and loyal as well to Chelsea for a long time. Of course, like you mentioned, Roman's billions certainly helped that. Regarding his former club, Chelsea, not a bad season so far. Bit of controversy here and there. They tied Liverpool this past midweek. 1-1, but given what happened around them, they actually gained some ground, and you know, it's a huge lead now at the top, which compelled Antonio Conte to say that only Chelsea can lose the title now, which I think speaks for itself. And given what you've seen so far, is there any contender who could possibly put some pressure on Chelsea at this point?
I mean, Chelsea are 9 points clear at the moment, and these back-to-back fixtures, the Liverpool game on Tuesday and then the Arsenal game that they've got coming up on Saturday, they've long been sort of sticking out in the calendar as the time when you think, well, if the wheels are going to come off, you know, they might well come off then. They weren't great at Liverpool, but at the same time, I think a draw was probably a fair result. I think the only question mark about Chelsea is what has happened this season has not been the culmination of a careful process whereby they've got better and better year on year. Obviously, they won the title 2 years ago with Jose Mourinho. We can't forget that. But this is a very different sort of team. They're playing a very different sort of football. And as a result, they are very dependent on their current momentum. And so far, when there have been setbacks, such as the defeat at Tottenham, which ended their 13-game winning run, they responded quite impressively. I suppose my question mark would be if this, you know, this burst of form comes to an end and they have two or three games where they don't win, are the foundations there? Is there enough depth in this squad? Are there enough other ways of playing for them to fight their way out of that? But yeah, as you say, it's very difficult to see Chelsea not winning the league. I suppose if you were trying to look for reasons to be optimistic for the chasing pack, you'd say that there are four teams who are all the same sort of distance away and all right, they're 9 or 10 points away, But if Chelsea lose and they all win, suddenly it's 6 points. And 6 and 9 points are very different. What the chasing pack need is for Chelsea to stumble. And when they do stumble, the chasing pack need to win. Obviously, that didn't happen this week, with the exception of Man City winning at West Ham. So it's hard to see any champion emerging from this season apart from Chelsea. But having said that, strange things happen in football. So let's wait and see.
Tom, the transfer window closed this week, and you know, we alluded to it at the top of the show. There was some movement. Hall was a big sort of player, but pretty quiet from the top four and the top five, top six teams who didn't sort of really make any sort of substantial moves. Did that surprise you?
No, it's been something of a trend in recent years. Deadline day in general, both the one at the end of the close season transfer window and the mid-season transfer window, the big clubs tend not to make too many big moves. Obviously, there are occasional exceptions. January in particular, certainly the last two or three seasons, the big clubs have tended not to splash the cash. And what you've seen is the teams at the lower ends of the table scrabbling around for bargains to try and turn their season around. Because I think what happens with the big clubs is they have their squads in place well in advance of the season in general. They have lots of resources in terms of playing staff. And if they need to move for a player in January, it's generally because someone's been injured or there's been a catastrophic loss of form or something. Whereas it's the guys lower down the table who were, you know, really desperate to try and avoid relegation. We saw that last season. Sam Allardyce at Sunderland very successfully brought in a few players who helped Sunderland stay up. He's made a few signings with Crystal Palace, hoping to do the same thing. Mamadou Sakho joining on loan from Liverpool, the most eye-catching of those. Hull, as you mentioned before, has signed a lot of players. Hull came into the season having not signed anyone and managed to limp through until January, still in touch. They're in the relegation zone, but they've not been cast adrift yet. Then find themselves losing two of their most important players in January, Jake Livermore and Robert Snodgrass. But they've brought 10 players in, I think, this month. And I must admit, I've watched Hull quite a lot the last few weeks, and Marco Silva has made a really impressive impact, their new manager. They held Man United to a 0-0 draw in their most recent game. They came very close to perhaps not knocking United out of the League Cup in the semi-finals, but they gave them a very good game. They were quite narrowly beaten at Chelsea, their last away game in the league. So, you know, they look to have turned a corner with Silva. Swansea, again, who were down there, have made a few signings. I'm not sure Sunderland have brought in as many players as they would have liked to. David Moyes has spoken about how frustrating he found the process of trying to get people to the Stadium of Light. Not a surprise, I think, the way it went, and probably in keeping with what we've seen in recent seasons.
Now, Man City, they brought in Jesus, but of course that deal was done a long time ago, but they could bring him in. He scores his first goal for the club yesterday as City destroy West Ham 4-0 in London in a game that Claudio Bravo was benched finally. I think it's one save in 2017 so far for Bravo. He's given up his last six shots he's given a goal up on. I suppose it's not a huge surprise that Bravo has finally been benched by Pep Guardiola, but do you see this being a long-term thing? Is this Willy Caballero's team now?
It's hard to know. Guardiola clearly made the recruitment of Claudio Bravo a very high priority, and it was a very symbolic thing to have done as well, to have banished Joe Hart, who ended up joining Torino on loan, and brought in Claudio Bravo. I think what has happened to Guardiola over the first 6 months of the season is that he has realised how difficult it is to play the sort of football his teams played at Barcelona and Bayern Munich in the Premier League. You can afford to have a goalkeeper who's a little bit suspect on crosses, who perhaps isn't doesn't have a great ratio in terms of shots to saves. If you're Barcelona or Bayern Munich, if you see 70% of possession in most of your games, if your centre-backs spend most of their matches standing around chatting to each other on the halfway line, waiting for moves to break down so they can feed the ball back into the midfielders. And he's not been able to do that at Man City. You know, City see a lot of the ball, but they're not able to dominate teams in the same way. And as a result, Bravo's shortcomings have been exposed in a way they never were at Barcelona, because he just didn't have anything like as much work to do. I mean, I suspect Guardiola is desperate for Bravo to become a success at Manchester City. I would have thought that he will come back into the team. But there's just it's very hard to know which Man City to expect at the moment, because they are capable of playing some tremendous football. But at the same time, they can get rattled. And, you know, they've been exposed very badly on quite a few occasions. So I think Guardiola is still kind of feeling his way into the job. But I think the rest of the team is starting to look more like the sort of team that he would like. I think Gabriel Jesus coming into the starting 11 and keeping his place could be very significant. There's been some mixed messages from Guardiola all season, really, about Sergio Aguero. The expectation was that he would make Aguero his attacking fulcrum. We know what a wonderful striker Aguero is, how prolific he is, how many important goals he scored for City. But every time Guardiola was given a chance to say something nice about Aguero in the first half of the season, he would sort of mix the nice with the not so nice, with the, well, he could do with working a little bit harder, and he's not exactly doing what I want him to do now. And I wouldn't be surprised if he saw Jesus as more his type of striker, someone who is a bit more hardworking, who looks for the pass a bit more, less of a kind of traditional single-minded goal scorer like Aguero is. But the last couple of games City have had, even prior to that, I mean, they were very impressive in the drawn game against Tottenham Hotspur at the end of January. They won very convincingly at Crystal Palace in the FA Cup. They won very convincingly at West Ham last night. And I think the team as it's set up at the moment, with Sane and Sterling wide, with Jesus in the middle, Silva and De Bruyne are in the middle sort of pulling the strings, and then either Yaya Toure or Fernandinho anchoring the midfield. I think Guardiola really likes that. I think he likes having that blend of pace and skill on the flanks with the sort of, you know, the know-how of Silva and De Bruyne, the eye for a killer pass, and then up front the skill and the industry and the awareness of Jesus. So I think City are getting there. But I think the goalkeeper issue will probably rumble on for a little bit longer.
It was nice also seeing Vincent Kompany in the FA Cup playing finally and just hoffing some balls up the field. You know, forget the typical Pep style, good old-fashioned centre-back play, which I think sometimes they might miss a little bit as well. Tom, listen, thank you so much for this. Enjoy the games this weekend, and we'll chat to you real soon.
Thanks very much. Cheers, guys.
Cheers, Tom.
That's Tom Williams of AFP. Follow Tom on Twitter, a great follow, at TomWFootball. It's funny talking about Man City here, because they are finding what they are quite late in the season, it would appear. And with Sergio Aguero, I mean, he's 28 now. And you do wonder that if he's not going to be reinvented, and you know, I know Pep's perhaps tried to reinvent him this season, hasn't worked out too great, you can still get a good price for Sergio Aguero in the market, a real good price.
Sure.
And as much as City have billions and billions of dollars, they are still a business. And it wouldn't surprise me at all to see Aguero go back to Spain this summer. If Jesus can prove in the next 15 or 16 games or so that he is actually, you know, ready for this stage.
Right.
And of course, they can go out and get some other talent as well.
Sure.
I just don't see, and Aguero's a legend then, so he should be. He's an incredible player. Mm-hmm. And injuries have been the big issue this season as well. But I don't know. There's something about that relationship between Pep and Kun Aguero that just doesn't sit right with a lot of fans. I know that.
Yeah. Well, I mean, we'll see. I mean, sometimes it takes players to sort of develop a rapport with managers, especially when they bring in a lot of change, right? So, give it some time. It'd be a shame if Man City just said, you know, at the end of the season, now we're going to wash our hands of Sergio Aguero and sell him off. It'd be nice to see them show a little bit more patience and see if, you know, things can work out. So we'll see.
Yep, we shall. But I think we'll see a very different scene next year. A lot of players moving out after Pep said his first year. I'm pretty certain of that.
Yeah, for sure.
Moving on now, it's been, I guess, for Canadian soccer fans, an emotional week. We said farewell to one of our best in Julian de Guzman, who finally hung him up after 21 years or so as a professional footballer.
Incredible when you think about it.
He's 35 now, almost 36, I should mention that. He's almost 36 in a couple of months' time. We're joined by Julian now on the phone. Julian, welcome to the show, mate. Do you feel like an ex-player just yet?
Not yet. I mean, I think that's going to kick in once I start coaching on the sidelines, just in the middle of preparing for a new season with the Ottawa Fury. But I can't say it officially feels like I'm an ex-player. But the first steps in making that happen with the announcement, I mean, that wasn't an easy process. So I think it's going to get a little harder from a lot of past ex-pros who always say they missed a game at some point, you know, down the road. And I think I'm going to encounter that moment at some point soon.
What led to the decision, Julian? Why now?
Well, I think it's just a lot of it has to do with the national team. And I mean, going back to 2012, first time I think retirement crossed my mind after the MLS. I wanted to spend more time with the family and get close to my kids and whatnot. But there was the opportunity of playing in Germany and, you know, being able to stay close to them. So that kept me active. But I kind of saw the retirement and staying away from the game for a bit and spending more time with the family after Greece. Took a couple of months off. But again, when, you know, Benito and the national team kept calling me in, and it was like impossible to say no. So that really kept my career alive for the last three years, I would say. And then not making the hex was the confirmation and the, I guess, the catalyst in me saying, you know what, this is what it's time for me to take a step back and, you know, where do I bring more value to the game, you know, as a person and, you know, maybe not a player anymore. And this is why I've made that step forward.
It's like Canada was the mafia, isn't it? You know, like, yeah, I'm sorry, no, yeah. You can't leave just yet. We're not ready for you to leave just yet. But, you know, it's funny, you know, I think overall football fans will remember you as that Deportivo player. Probably the best time of your career from a player. You're incredible. But Canadian fans certainly will remember you just in that Canadian red, or seem to always be there. How hard was it in recent months, even the last couple of years, mentally and physically? You know, you're playing in a team that had a bit of potential, but not a hell of a lot, in fairness. You know, it's going to be a battle making that hex. Was it difficult to, you know, put those boots on?
Very, very, very difficult. You know, you have a world-class coach such as Benito comes in with his philosophy and ideas, and, you know, every Canadian that was under Benito experienced the exact same thing I experienced when I first went to Spain. And, you know, that language barrier and being able to understand, you know, what tactics meant and where their ideas came from. I went through all that. And this was part of football, you know, my journey playing in Europe, playing abroad. You know, you learn different cultures, you learn different ideas, you learn different strategies and everything. And you have to be open to that. Now, that was what my trick to the trade in terms of being able to adapt to different cultures. And that was the case with Canadians trying to learn what Benito wanted for his team. So it was a tough process, but me being there and trying to have kind of, you know, getting the guys on board and on the same page was a tough task. And at the same time, to be honest, when I compare the best times I've had with the national team, the talent we had during our golden years, if we had that under Benito, I would imagine, a lot would have been different. And if we had, if we had Steven Hart, you know, managing from 2007 and onwards, if he was in full control, I could put my hand down that we would have been in the World Cup in South Africa. But you know, that the talent then versus now, it's a lot different. But I still don't doubt that we have made some steps, you know, forward, and the talent just still does exist. So hopefully it comes together, and hopefully we could make it happen. And I think a lot of people still do believe, such as myself.
Julian, not too many Canadian players have played at the highest club level in Europe, but you know, you're one of the few who has. I mean, a very distinguished career in Germany and especially in Spain with Deportivo La Coruña. But at the start of your career, I mean, it was a bit of a struggle for you because you know, as a teenager, you left home and then, you know, the thing with Holland didn't work out and then you went to France and you ended up, you know, moving on to Germany. Can you talk about sort of that early struggle in your career and what it was like for a Canadian player trying to prove himself to European clubs that, yeah, I'm good enough and I am good enough to play at this level?
Yeah, mentally, I really prepared myself. My brother. I knew it was going to be a struggle from the get-go. And even just trying to make the national team and the provincial team in my own country was also a struggle. So I've had many coaches who've put me through that, and I've always told myself the survival of the fittest are the ones who will get that opportunity. And if they want it, if it means that much to them, then they'll do anything it takes. So I knew psychologically at a young age that 90% of the game was mental. And I've been preached that from young, and that was always a different maker for a lot of you Canadians who've gone to Europe and never survived because they're either homesick, a culture shock, or they just couldn't keep up with the competition that came their way. So going to France, you know, as a Canadian, I knew I was taking someone's spot. That was from France. And why would they want a Canadian? You know, and all it took was one coach who believed in me, and I had the chance to prove myself, and I didn't let that moment slip away from me after my lesson that I learned in Holland. And I knew it was a tough task, but someone had to do it. And I wasn't going to let that moment pass my way and become another statistic and come back with a story saying, hey, I didn't make it because I missed home or whatnot. I had to be different, and I knew I had to suffer. So that was the biggest jump in terms of trying to break the ice for Canadians. And I mean, not just myself, but I know other guys like Saltieri, Tiba, you know, who've gone overseas and made the difference. Those are guys who, you know, we need more of, or even better, if we want to succeed as a country. And from France to Germany to Spain, you know, I've always carried that maple leaf, and I was always proud to put our country on the map in some of the greatest leagues in the world.
Yeah, well said. I mean, it must be so difficult for a young guy to go to, you know, a new country, a new club, and straight away know that his passport already counts against him, and he's got to get over that. I think that's a testament to character, you know, to get through that. You know, looking at the way the game is today, if MLS was where it is now when you were emerging in your late teens, do you think you would have stuck around a bit longer in North America before making that switch?
Yeah, I probably wouldn't have gone to Europe. You know, I find MLS it's been great for Canadians to think that they have a professional league just in their back door or backyard. Sorry, but at the same time, I think it's still a struggle, you know, for Canadians to get that respect and that welcome. And and if you count the amount of Canadians that play outside of Canadian clubs in the MLS, there's not very many, you know, and if they're even part of a team, how often do they actually play? And that goes the same for even the Canadian teams in the MLS. So it remains a struggle for the Canadians that are playing in MLS or even in Europe, who now just play in third divisions or fourth divisions. We as a country, I think it comes down to where do we stand in the FIFA rankings? What type of respect do we get? Because I remember when I was playing in Germany, the amount of Canadians that were playing, there's you know, a lot of guys playing Bundesliga, like Rob Friend, Spalteri, Kevin McKenna, you know, myself, Olivier Ocean. You know, we had players that actually did play at the Bundesliga. Today, it's scarce, you know, to find Canadians now playing in top divisions. And once the country does get better and starts to improve and starts to get that respect, then you'll find more teams in the MLS and maybe in Europe welcoming Canadians to to their clubs, and that's one thing that we've been missing. And at the end of the day, you know, we don't have a professional league of our own, so that's always been a tough task to deal with. And today, after almost 19 years, when I left home, we didn't have a professional league or professional teams. Now we have five of them. You know, that's a start and something to be thankful for, but obviously there's still more that needs to be done.
Of course, one of the professional teams in Canada you played for in Toronto FC. Julian, when you look back at your time with Toronto, I mean, how would you evaluate it? I don't know, from my feeling was that you never really got a fair shake from a lot of people, because it seemed like a lot was expected of you, and maybe unfairly, because, you know, they kind of heralded you as, you know, the savior as the club and, you know, an attacking midfielder, but you really weren't quite that player. I mean, to be perfectly honest, what did you make of Toronto and just the whole expectations of you when you first came in here?
You know, it wasn't easy. It was obviously probably one of my hardest moments for myself, but if I had to be the one to take all the, you know, the criticism and if I was the one being used to help educate and make the game grow for Canadians and the culture of soccer in Canada, then I'm okay with that, because someone had to do it, and it had to start at some point. And I'm glad it happened, because if you look at it today now, you know, Toronto FC has not making that same mistake anymore and going about signing certain players. They're not making that same mistake anymore by creating false hype. You know, they are educating your average Canadian and becoming better fans and better supporters of the game. And now they have a much more complete team than they have when I was around, when D-Roll was around. Mm-hmm. You know, the role players that we had versus the role players that TFC has now, mm-hmm. it's a lot different. Now they've created an actual team. They have a system. People understand what you know, where each player's roles are. Back then they didn't. But we had to start somewhere, and I think that's going to be the same task and same struggle we will actually have if we do have our own league. The quality may not be the best, but it's got to start somewhere. And I'm very proud and happy that I went through that hard time with TFC. Especially being in my hometown, being in my country, these are the sacrifices and the struggles that I don't mind dedicating my life for, to help the game grow. And I'm still honored and proud that I was the one that stood up and took that opportunity to make the game grow.
I'm pretty sure most Canadian fans who watched you for TFC, they knew, the true fans knew what you were as a player. And I think they respected the effort you put in, certainly. I remember when you first arrived interviewing you, and it was just after I'd spoke to Mo Johnston. He was saying, oh, yeah, we're going to put Julian in his attacking midfield role, and he's going to score goals. And then I kind of put that to you, and you're like, kind of a defensive midfielder, you know? You're like, yeah. At what point did you kind of realize, oh, crap, what do they think I am here?
I saw it in the contract. I mean, they had scoring bonuses that would pay me $10,000 a goal, like $5,000 for an assist. I'm like, what? I asked my agent Courtney James. I was like, what are they doing here? And I mean, obviously you're going to sign that, right? Yeah. But will I live up to those expectations? And I knew right then and there, it was false imaging. I mean, I saw a presentation video that they had for me. The video must have lasted like 7 minutes of me scoring goals.
But I've had a lot of replays, right?
Yeah, they're all replays from different angles. It makes it look like that I've scored maybe almost like 30 goals in my career, which I haven't even scored more than a handful, right? So things like that was eye-opening, and I was like, wow, this is actually different. I've never seen anything like this before in Europe, you know, where it's supposed to be the promised land of soccer. Here I am in my backyard where I'm from, where I've always dreamt of playing professional soccer, having a professional team, and being in such an environment where there's your own fans and your family and everything. But I was like, this is all wrong, but maybe, and I'm not saying I did it on purpose, obviously I'm going to do anything possible to you know, give it my best, but maybe it was the right thing that has happened that way, and it was a learning curve for not just myself and the fans, but also for the organization and the franchise themselves to help them grow and understand the game a little more. And now you could see they make better signings, they make better decisions, and that was I guess the growing pains of becoming a better franchise. So I'm glad it happened, and but again, it was a very crazy and interesting experience, and I definitely don't regret it.
Especially where you came from, and we should quickly mention, you know, I want to hear your thoughts on those 4 or 5 years you spent at Deportivo La Coruña, and a couple in particular where the team was outstanding, one of the best teams in Spain, and you were arguably the most important player. You, in fact, were the club MVP that 1 year. That time in Spain, is that the era that do you think personifies you as a footballer?
Yeah, this was for me, the best moments of my life as a football player, playing in Spain. I wish I had Bein Sports back then. I mean, nothing against you guys, but
hey man, we should highlight some Sports World on the Score. I made a point, pal.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, you actually do have highlights. No, it's true. I wish they had. There wasn't a lot of La Liga growing up, and there hasn't been obviously. But I mean, I was a big fan of La Liga growing up, and just to be a part of that era where they had all the stars of the league, from Raquel May, David Villa at Valencia, Luis Fabiano, Canute at Sevilla, Forlán, it just goes on, and then Madrid and Barcelona. Like, for me to be amongst those guys, and I was man marking these guys and putting in tackles, and my job as a defensive midfielder. Just to fight and become the player of the year for my team in that league. Like, when I think of that sometimes, like, I don't believe it. And I still feel like I have to watch these videos and tapes over again to make sure it actually happened. But I'm honored too, you know, as a Canadian to leave that behind and to hopefully create something for the future. And if there's any other Canadian that could ever do it, you know that it's possible. So it was a wonderful moment for me during those years, and I'll definitely cherish that. And it has made me the player I've always wanted to become, playing in the leagues. I'm honored, and just to even hear about a coach tell me to play the Claude Makélélé position, and that was a player growing up when I was in Marseille. My job as a ball boy was to watch Claude Makélélé when he was at Marseille growing up. And, you know, I watched him growing up as a ball boy. He gets sent out to Celta Vigo. And then next thing you know, I'm in Spain being told to play that position. And for me, that's a journey itself as a footballer. And that was a dream come true. So but when at TFC, I don't think anyone could even tell you what Claude Makélélé was like, you know, signing in 2009. For millions of dollars, so that's the whole backwards thing about it. We made a lot of progress, and I'm honestly proud to see TFC make big jumps and strides, and the entire country itself in general. It's the culture is growing, and I'm honestly proud of it, and I'm happy.
So going forward, Julian, obviously, you know, you're staying on with the Ottawa Fury as an assistant coaching role. That's great, great for Ottawa and you know, football in the Canadian capital. But I'm wondering, any plans to do anything with the CSA? Have they kind of reached out to you in terms of, you know, getting you involved with them, either in coaching or holding training camps or anything like that?
Yeah, I mean, I'm in touch with Tony. I was involved in the under-15 camp in Vaughan with Staltieri and Ante Jazic a couple of months ago, and I made it clear to everyone at CSA, you know, Peter, Vic, Tony. I said, hey, you know, I don't care what you guys want me to do, but I want to be a part of this, and I need to be a part of this, and I'm honored to, you know, take that opportunity to do whatever just to help this team grow. I'm right now in the middle of trying to figure out what the best role is for me, and Ottawa as a Canadian team, being Canadian, this is also a dream come true to have this opportunity to have a role as an assistant coach, an assistant GM, and then learn the trades. I mean, it's a new world for me. It's one thing being a player, just getting information from a coach, but now it's a matter of now me giving all that information to players and to clubs, and to even on the business side of things, to help this game grow in the country. So I will do anything and everything for my country on the soccer level of things. And I'm honestly very happy and proud of this whole transition and the way it's happened within Canada. And I want this to happen not just for myself, but for the rest of the professionals who are close to their retirement to really stay involved and contribute and give back to what this country and the future needs.
And the CSA does need to embrace its former players, I think, a lot more.
Absolutely.
In that regard. By the way, say hi to Bruce Grobbelaar for me, will you? When you see him at training
yeah,
there.
Yeah, well, I will say that, yeah, he's a great guy. The jungle man.
That's right. Listen, Julian, before we leave, I want to quickly apologize to you for all those numerous times I asked you about your brother, Jonathan, and will he play for Canada. It seemed every week I asked you questions about it, man. I had to, it was my job. I hated doing it, but I had to do it. So I do apologize, but you're always very candid and very forthcoming in your answers there. So I appreciate it, mate. And listen, congratulations on a fantastic career.
Yeah.
And enjoy
the
future. You're still a young man. You've got plenty of years in football left ahead of you.
Thank you. And I appreciate the support, guys. And also, you guys like you, John and James, you guys help create the culture, and we definitely need you guys and more of it involved. So it's growing. We never had this before. And like you said, we need to appreciate a lot of the Canadians who have gone to battles and for the country, and they need to, a lot of recognition down the road. So I appreciate the attention and the support you guys have given us.
Well, thank you very much, mate. Take care, pal.
Best of luck, buddy.
All right. Take care, man.
Cheers.
That is Julian de Guzman. It's funny. I was thinking about other great Canadian footballers, and obviously Atiba kind of stands out, and Julian obviously stole Terry. But, as far as being recognized back home, the Lou Marsh Award sits there, right, to honor the best in Canadian sports every year, right? Never has a soccer player won it, right?
I think that's right, yeah.
Because players like Julian and Atiba operate under the radar. You're telling me back in 2000 and what year was it, 8? At Deportivo, when he had that fantastic year.
Yeah.
He wasn't a candidate for that kind of award. Give me a break. He's one of the best players in arguably the best league in the world.
That was an Olympic year, though, wasn't it? 2008. They would have been the 2008 Olympics in Beijing.
Right.
So,
sure.
I mean, the way that I've understood that the Lou Marsh has always kind of worked is that there's kind of an unwritten rule or understanding that in an Olympic year, it's always going to go to a Canadian Olympic. I mean, unless, there's extenuating circumstances like some.
But to even be discussed, though.
Yeah, I don't know what to tell you, James.
And listen, if anyone on Lou Marsh panel out there, and if you were there when Atiba or Julian or whoever was at least discussed,
right,
let us know.
I think part of the problem is with Julian, and this is no disrespect to him whatsoever, because I think he is one of the best footballers this country has ever produced. But had he been a forward, like a goal scorer,
sure,
at Deportivo La Coruña, and he was really kind of lighting up the league, then there probably would have been more of a discussion. I just think the fact that he, the type of player that he was, kind of a more defensive holding midfielder, people like you and I and, the average soccer fan, we can appreciate that.
Sure.
But I'm not sure the mainstream sports fan will kind of really understand, what the significance of that.
It's a good point.
That sort of worked against him.
And same for Atiba as well.
Absolutely,
right?
Yeah.
So it's a very good point, yeah.
Yeah.
We need goals, man.
Yeah.
Goals, points. That's what we need.
Yeah.
That's what we appreciate.
Well, and
we understand points and goals.
Yeah.
And tackles made.
And winning, too. I mean, had they been a little bit more successful, again, this is no disrespect to Julian or Atiba, but had the Canadian national team been a little bit more successful during their stints, qualifying for the World Cup would have been huge, right?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So that certainly would have drawn them a lot more attention. I certainly think that kind of worked against them as well.
Sure, absolutely. But I'm just thinking that one or perhaps 2 years at Deportivo, he was amongst the best.
Like he was, as I said at the top, he was one of the best midfielders in Spain. And for a Canadian, we're saying this about a Canadian player, mm-hmm, playing at the very highest level in La Liga in Spain for, Deportivo La Coruña. They weren't Barcelona or Real Madrid, but at the time they were a very good club. So that's saying a lot. So it's just a shame that he didn't get a bit more sort of recognition at the time.
Didn't they finish second that one year? I think they finished second when Julian was their MVP. Pretty sure.
You might have, yeah.
Then it runs up to...
I can't recall.
To Barca.
Might have been. I do.
It probably was Boston.
I do remember they did win La Liga. Like in, I want to say, like before Julian was there. Mm-hmm. I think I want to say in, Yeah, or something like that. Or maybe it had been in earlier. Was it 2000? No,
I can't remember now.
Yeah.
But I remember that as well. Yeah. Yeah. It was it's before Atletico rebuilt.
Yeah. Oh, very much.
Right.
Yeah.
It was in that window there.
Yeah.
Different era.
Very much different era. Yeah.
Different era. All right, listen, we're almost out of time. This weekend, they're coming up on Sportsnet. We have a beauty for you. Early doors, 7 a.m. Eastern on Saturday morning. Chelsea-Arsenal.
That'll be a good one.
Your Gunners coming off that loss to Watford, JMO. Yeah, got to bounce back and keep this race interesting.
Yeah, I think it's done.
We have Palace against Sunderland at 9:30, along with Southampton-West Ham on Sportsnet.
That'll be a good one.
Absolutely. And on Sportsnet World, the late one on Saturday, sees Spurs against Middlesbrough. Sunday, a couple for you here. Leicester, Manchester United and Sportsnet World at 10:30 Eastern. And, just the one, sorry.
Just the one on Sunday.
Just the one, yeah. So I thought it was two. Just the one. So that's our weekend across the network. What's happening on the site, sportsnet.ca?
Lots of stuff. Your blog is going up tomorrow. We've got you and Jimmy Brennan doing a video preview of the weekend. We're going to have the big question, which is related to the title race. We'll have full sort of like Premier League preview. And we've got a piece up right now on Arsenal and Chelsea written by Graham Ruthven. So a lot of good stuff.
Yeah, the big question this week, you'll see it shortly on the website. It is, which team in the Premier League this season will finish second? Because, you know, we're crowning Chelsea champions. We are. It's official.
Okay.
Champs. Arsenal, Man City, Spurs, Liverpool, Manchester United. Who's going to finish second? Everton fans, I'm sorry. You don't get a spot there.
Was Liverpool in there? In here?
Yes, they were.
Okay.
Were they there?
I don't know. I can't remember if you said them. Okay.
Whose idea was this? Big question.
Yours.
Right.
Yeah.
And you think that I would put Liverpool
That's
in there?
True. I should have.
Yeah.
Realized.
Shame, JMO. Our thanks to Tom Williams of AFP and, of course, Julian de Guzman. I am James Sharman. Here's John Molinaro. Eric Primer's behind the glass. I hope you enjoyed that. And we'll be back on Monday, I believe, with Dobby Dunlop. And yours truly. Cheers for listening.